Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein. This is a response a day. Thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you, and I always appreciate the fact that people are willing to share Torah with me and give me the opportunity to share some Torah with them. So thank you for being here. Today we're going to study a tshuva by the Sri De'esh on the size of openings in order to allow ritual impurity to go from one place to the other. Now, as soon as I say those words, it already sounds a little technical. It is a little technical. And part of the point of this series is to try to make sure that we embrace in ways that are still enjoyable for us to learn and still interesting, but things that areas of halakha that we might not otherwise come to, areas of halakha that we might otherwise sort of neglect. And it's part of recognizing the breadth of halakha, with the D in there. It's part of recognizing that halakha covers a whole range of areas, and it won't show up in this tshuva, but it's important to me to remember that whole range also intertwines and intersects. So there are many times when, so for example, just something that struck me years ago, is the Magen Avraham, who only produced a commentary on the Orach Chaim section of Shulchan Aruch, that we have, that's published, that we use, that's widely known. Yet you learn Magen Avraham, and it's clear that the man had control, as my teacher, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, used to say, the man had control. He was easily familiar with the entire range of halakha, and it figured into his understanding of issues that might seem restricted to one area of the Shulchan Aruch, one area of Jewish law. So this will be an example of that, and I hope that it'll be also an enjoyable experience. Remember that the Sri De'esh is Michiel Yaakov Weinberg. He was an important Rav in Germany before the war. He was at the Hildesheimer Seminary until it was closed, and then after World War II, he lived the rest of his life in Montreux, Switzerland, writing tshuvot to people and a well-recognized and very important Torah scholar. So in Sri De'esh, that's his tshuvot, Sri De'esh meaning the leftovers of the fire. This is from the first volume, Chelek Aleph, Simon Kuf Ayin Tet, responsa number 179. For reasons that are beyond me, the Bar Ilan responsa project includes the page numbers in the book as the identifying factor of these tshuvot. I don't know why, since he also numbers his tshuvot, but it's from page Tuf Kuf Samach Gimel, from page 563 is where it starts. So he is having a discussion with a Rav who used to be a Rav in Königsberg. This is a tshuva, I'm sorry, from the 26th of Tammuz, right, which is our day. And it's from the 26th of Tammuz, and it's right into, yes, a man who used to be a Rav in Königsberg, and now is in London, right? This is a time in Jewish history where many people had two identities, because they had been somewhere before the war, and then if they survived, thank God they survived, they would be somewhere else. So the building in this man's congregation, they have a cemetery, they have a Beit HaKvura, and they're going to have some kind of a partition around it. And the question is, that they're dealing with is, can they have that partition have holes in it of any sort? Like, let's say a lattice work is going to be the kind of issue that will come up. And what you want is that it be something that's chotzeitz bifnei tumah. You want it to stop tumah, ritual impurity, from the cemetery, from the Beit HaKvarot, and transferring elsewhere. Because for a simple example, if Kohanim want to be in this other area, let's say even if this other area is a shul, so if the shul is going to have some connection, it's going to be the Beit HaKvarot, the Beit HaChayim, the cemetery is going to be near the shul, and they're going to be so, they're going to be adjacent to each other, and you want the Kohanim to be able to be in shul without having to worry about it, that'll be the kind of a question. Similar questions come up in lots of areas. Let's say somebody's building a hospital. So sadly, sometimes people die in hospitals. So if, let's say, you wanted to make a hospital where Kohanim could come in some way and not have to worry about that, what are the kinds of barriers and partitions that you would have to put up? So this is, in some sense, a technical question, but it's a technical question that has immediate ramifications for halachic practice and for building spaces, halachic spaces that Jews can use, especially Kohanim. And that's how the question comes up. And it gets into other questions as well. But this is the question for now. So he says, first I'll tell you that everything that you wrote about how you define rooms and zizim, when pieces of material or pieces of wood or something stick out over something, and whether that does or does not constitute an ohel, a tent, and a covering, which will bring, in some cases, ritual impurity from one place to the other, that we're not going to deal with, because since Sri Deish says that's all well said and well put together, and I have nothing to add, and you know, you read the poskim right, you read the previous authorities correctly, you know what you're talking about, and so there's nothing to say there. You got it all right. I agree with you at everything, but and I guess as I read that, one of the things that I'm reminded of is that very often the people asking the question in these situations are not nobodies themselves. They're people of competence, of well-versed learning, who raise a good point and have a question, have an issue, and they turn to somebody else. I've seen before, Chivot where the Tzitzeliezer will talk to Rav Uziel, and they're both clearly scholars of rank, and they consult with each other on questions. And that's a part of the Sicha Shel Torah, the conversation of Torah, is that somebody doesn't just decide they know everything on their own. They turn to somebody else, and that somebody else isn't always more clearly senior or more clearly of greater rank than them. It's just somebody else for other opinions. Okay, so now to the Sri Deish says, but when it comes to the size of the holes, so this is a continuing conversation between them, the size of the holes, and the question would be, how small does the hole have to be for me to say that halakhically we can ignore it? Theoretically, obviously one could have said, well, if there's any hole, that brings tumah from one place to the other, but that's not the halakha. So the question was, the man who's writing to him had suggested sources that say that until the hole is a tefach, now a tefach is 3 to 4 inches, it depends on shiurim, is always a question, halacha is another question, they don't get into the specific numbers, but we today, for example, it was well known that Rabbi Soloveitchik, we don't rule this way anymore, but Rabbi Soloveitchik had said that if a tefach is about 4 inches, then a mechitza, even in shul, only needs to be about 40 inches, which is 3 feet, which is much lower than mechitza that we have today. So, depending on what a tefach was, right? And that affects your definition of a tefach, affects your definition of an ama, and that affects your definition of all sorts of things like it affects your sense of time and how much time after Shabbos you have to wait, whether it's 72 minutes or 45 minutes. The question of the size of a tefach is not clear, but it's an important question. So it could be anywhere from 3 to 4 inches, somewhere in the 3 to 4 inches range, and there are 6 tefachs to an ama, and that's how you get the size. So I'm sorry, I think Rav Soloveitchik actually held even shorter for the mechitza. Okay, so if the hole could be a tefach, that would mean that if you had even, let's say, lattice work, where the break between pieces of the lattice, like the holes that are created, are 3 inches, that would still be smaller than the halacha would say that that tumah can pass through, and therefore that would constitute a perfectly good partition to prevent tumah, to prevent ritual impurity from coming through. But the Sri Deish disagrees. He thinks that when it comes to ritual impurity, to tumah and tahara, it's got to be smaller than a pundion. So a pundion was a coin in the time of the Mishnah. It's much, much smaller, obviously, than 3 inches. And we're going to see that the other term that's going to be used for it is kimlo mikdach, which is going to be like a drill bit. So depending how big of a drill bit is, but it's a much smaller hole. And he thinks it's a much smaller hole, basically meaning that you'd pretty much have to have a solid wall. I guess you could have a very, very, you had, you know, chicken wire fences where the holes were extremely small. That could be it as well, but that's what he holds. And why does he hold that way? So now there are going to be sources we're going to talk about. And the sources in Mishnayot, they talk about windows. So there's a Mishnah in Ahalot, and the Mishnah in Ahalot says, Chalon Shehu La'avir. So in the time of the Mishnah, windows were not as common as they are today. You didn't have glass being used regularly for covering windows. So if you had a window, it would really be open space, and so you'd have limits on what you were going to do. So you'd have different kinds of windows. So a chalon shehu la'avir is how the Mishnah speaks about it. A window that is for the purpose of having air. So bana bayit kutzala shi'ura b'poteach tefach. If there's a house on the other side, if there's some kind of structure outside that window, it's not considered a window until it is a tefach large. That's the way the Mishnah Olot says it. And the Rambam says when there's a house, so it explains exactly that way. If it becomes a window between two structures, then it can't be l'ora anymore. It can't be for light because the structure just outside the house is going to prevent the light from coming in, right? It's a blocked exposure now, and therefore it's got to be, it has to be a full tefach before we have to worry about it. So this Rav who was writing to the Sri Deish had added another Mishnah right there, which said, if you try to make an opening to be able to see, let's say, to get to see the scenery, or to speak with one's friend, right? So it's a functional window in some way, and it's a functional place in some way. There too, it says, poteach tefach. So his conclusion was that if you're going to make a hole in a wall to see from it, or the people who go, just to be able to see who's going by, or to speak with somebody, that'll have to be like a chalon that's made for use, and therefore it should be, it have to be a tefach before it counts as a window in halacha. So the Sri Deish says, it's a good point. I think you found important sources, and we have to talk about them. But, he says, but you also know, because you mentioned it, a Tosot Bava Batra, as we watch this, let's remember, the person asking the question is knowing all these sources, which means that when one is going to approach a halakhic topic, it's important to first make a review of the halakhic sources and sort of know them for one's own. Shebachor Hasudir Ot Vlishmor Shiro Pinjon. That there's another kind of a wall that the Gemara knows about, the Tosfot at least know about, and they say if it's a hole, that, and the way that Tosfot expresses it is that it's to see and to guard over things, and there it's a much smaller size, it's the punyon size, the small coin size. So according to the questioner, Sudeish points out, it almost seems like Tosfot missed the two Mishnah in Ohalot that are expressed, and as we've seen, to the idea that people, especially Tosfot, would just miss open and explicit Mishnayot that are just sitting there is inconceivable. Right? So there's one option, maybe there's an opinion in the Tosefta that might hold differently, and he says you can't hold that way because there's no way to say that they would hold like a Tosefta that goes against our Mishnah. So he says, so you have to conclude that the Mishnah is referring to two different kinds of chalanot, two different kinds of openings for different kinds of purposes. There are openings where the person wants a view, and the point of being able to see is to be able to see, to enjoy the seeing, right? It's a matter of pleasure, or to speak comfortably with a friend, meaning not that you just manage to, you know, not like in those prison movies where you Morse code through the walls. So here it would be not where you can just happen to whisper something and it'll get through because there's a little bit of an opening for the sound waves to pass through without having to first go through some kind of solid structure. It means that it's a comfortable conversation and you can speak easily and comfortably. So those, he says, would be like a window that's made for use. And there, generally people make the opening big enough so that it can be functional, it can really be useful. So in those situations, it's got to be a tefach. That's what the Mishnah means. So the definition of the opening that's required or that will be seen as a functional opening depends on what the function of the opening is. In the cases where the opening is for some kind of a use where it's supposed to be easy and pleasurable, not just that you could plausibly use it for that way, so that'll be for a tefach. But you can also have an opening whose purpose is, he says, Lashkiach al Pardesim, that I'm trying to look out through this window, not for the fun of looking out, but because it'll give me a way to see my property in some way and to make sure and be able to notice if somebody's coming into my property. That's not about enjoying it. That's just about whether or not it can work, whether or not when I look through it, I can see what's going on there. And in those situations, and another example he says would be that sound would come through it. So let's say somebody is, there's a public speaker in the other room, and I just want to make sure, all I want is that the people in this room should be able to hear it. So there, a much smaller opening can functionally work. So there, in other words, if there's a public speaker in the next room, and they're speaking loudly, they don't care if it's a big hole or a small hole, only all that, and there are people in, you know, the second location, for whatever reason. Today, you have overflow locations sometimes, so you'll have a, you know, closed circuit camera. So here too, let's suppose that you're not going to be able to see the person, and that everybody understands, but they want to be able to hear him. So how big is the opening going to be? So there he thinks that once the opening is like a punyon, even a much smaller opening, that will qualify as an opening because it will fulfill its function, and therefore it's considered halakhically a full opening in terms of fulfilling its function, and therefore it'll be an opening halakha, and we'll have to see those two spaces as connected by the opening. So then the question will be, what is the, in the context they were talking about, what's the function of the opening? So he says that the function was to be able to hear somebody. So it's not clear in the tshuva. It might be that they're building a cemetery and they want to have some way that Kohanim can hear the eulogies. Right? Kohanim priests are not allowed to go into a cemetery because they're not allowed to get themselves ritually impure other than for close relatives. So let's say a good friend passes away and somebody nearby is a Kohen who wants to in some way participate in the funeral. So I was actually sadly just at the funeral yesterday, and what they're going to do is they stand outside. So now many structures, many spaces that are going to be used as places for funerals will set up a sound system. So they can be in a place that's completely separate with no problems of any of these issues, and the sound system will let them hear the eulogies and be part of it. I mean, if anyone want to come, they want to honor the person who's passed away by their presence, which they can do by standing outside. But once they're doing it, you'd also prefer that they be able to hear. So it seems like in this situation, the community was thinking, trying to build a structure where you could have the funeral and the Kohanim could be in a separate space and hear everything. And the idea was to build separation, a barrier that will make them in a completely separate space, but put in holes that would allow the sound to travel through. And the question was, how big could those holes be? So this Rav had thought maybe you can make them even as large as the tefach, because of the sources that he cited that said up until the tefach is not a full hole for seeing. And the Sudeish is saying, but here the holes, as soon as the holes are big enough that you can hear the eulogies, that's going to be all that's really needed, because that's all they really care about it, and therefore, and they don't have to see, but once they can hear, that's going to be a problem, and he thinks that that's even a punyon size does that, and once it does that, then you have a problem, then they have an issue. That's what the Sudeish understands the situation. And then he says the Rav could agree with me because he's talking about a different thing in his situation. And this Rav had brought up the idea of, well, what if there's another structure right next to it? Meaning this is a blocked exposure. And we had seen a mission that said once the exposure is blocked, then you need a full tefach before it counts as an opening. Sudeish says, well, that was only if the point of that opening was to have air come in, right? To bring in air from the outside. If it's an air window, if that's the point of the window, then the blocked exposure does something. But if the issue is something completely different, like having sound waves come from one place to the other, then that doesn't affect the size of the opening. And then he quotes from Rishonim and Achronim, who he thinks point to agreeing with him, and that's a back and forth that we're not going to get into here, because that'll depend on seeing those original sources. But then he does an interesting thing that comes up in halakhic sources once he's constructed his idea that there's two sizes, and the two sizes depend on the uses that are involved. And if it's a matter of watching and seeing for enjoyment, or being able to speak comfortably with a friend, that will be a larger opening, that will be a tefach opening. And if it's only functional in terms of being able to hear and allow sound to pass through, or being able to see, basically be able to see what's going on outside, that will be a much smaller hole, that will be a punyon size, the size of a small coin. The notes of the Sifrei Zutin, Pashat Chukat, seems to contradict what he's saying, because there it says, Oseh petach beina levein bita, beina levein chavertav, somebody's making an opening between two women who are going to be in different rooms. And it says there, l'hashmi'a takol l'hadlik araner, to hear a voice, and then to have air enough to be able to light a candle. That has to be a tefach. So there, l'hashmi'a takol, sounds like they're going to be talking to each other, and it's a hole that's made for them to be able to use it to enjoy each other in some way. Nonetheless, he says, we have to say differently. Now, why do we have to say differently? Because he's got all these issues that he's already raised. He's come to his conclusion already based on other sources. He doesn't think this is an explicit enough source to tear down the whole structure, the whole idea that he's built up. And therefore, he says, you have to say that what it says, l'hashmi'a takol, it means for them to talk comfortably with each other. And that, yes, would require a tefach. Not l'hashmi'a, because he had said, l'hashmi'a takol, if you just want the voices from one place to be able to go into the other place, that only needs a much smaller, a kimlo punyo, and a coin size, a small coin size. But so here you'd have to say that when it says l'hashmi'a takol, it doesn't mean to let voices pass, it means for them to speak comfortably with each other, and that's why you need a larger hole. Points out that the Chacham Adam, which is from the century previous to his, from the 19th century, had said that if you have a window between two houses and it's the window has lattice work, or a screen is another good one, right? A screen would have openings too small for those things. So if you have something like that, you need that the opening be a punyon's worth before it would be an issue, because he says our windows are made for ora. And yet, so that would have gone against it, but another book called the Chaye Aryeh had asked his explicit question from the sources that they've already been discussing, and came out with the conclusion of the Sudeish, so he was happy. Yeah, but he raises the question, and he saw all the sources that Sudeish had seen, and he doesn't come to the conclusion that Sudeish should come to the conclusion, and therefore he thinks Sudeish, with all due respect to those who had come before him, he thinks the conclusion of what he had said is the conclusion that these two sizes for these openings. So to summarize, you have this debate, this discussion. It's not a new discussion for them, and it depends how one reads the sources and how one comes to understand them. The Aish's position was there are two sizes of openings for windows for various purposes. Depending on what the function of the window is, that'll affect the size that we care about. It becomes the minimum size for it to be qualified as a window in halacha, and that will affect questions of how we build certain things, especially in terms of issues of tumah and tara, of when we assume that tumah passes from one space to the other. Okay, so that didn't take us our full time, so I actually found a very brief tshuva of the Sri D'Eish on another issue, a much more commonly interesting issue, a much more generally interesting issue. He wrote on the 10th of Av, I could have saved it for then, but he's responding to a letter from the 26th of Tammuz, and since I didn't want today to be only about issues that perhaps seem too technical to people, I'm going to talk about this tshuva. It's from Chelik Bet Simon Ayin Hey, from the second part, from the 75th responsum, Amud Tavkuf Nindalit, for page 554. And interestingly, he's writing on the 10th of Av of Tavshin Yud Gimel of 1953, and he apologizes that the letter came on the 26th of Tammuz, and he only is getting around to it now. I find that interesting because other Meshivim who refer to the timing of their letters very often let much more than 2 weeks pass between the letter having been received or sent and responding to it. But Sri D'Eish was apparently much more conscientious about keeping up with his correspondence. This is an old question. I think we may have seen it briefly other times, but we can see it briefly now again. The question was, let's say, a man was living with a woman, and she had been converted by a certain Rav, and she had gone through a full conversion. So that's not our usual question in this context, but it is, because in this case, all of it was only before one other woman. That was who witnessed the conversion immersion, and the halacha is that in some sense is a tense halacha today, and people are talking about ways of doing it, but the halacha is that the immersion would seem to require to be required to be before three men, and how you do that in a tzanua way, in a modest way, is a whole discussion. It's not our discussion for now, so I'm not going to even touch it, but it's an important topic to think of on its own. But it was clear that it wasn't handled properly because there wasn't a Beit Din for any part of her conversion. And now the husband wants to have her convert in front of a full Beit Din to have a full important conversion. And the Rav that he's writing to is worried about it because we have a general halacha that if a man is known, this works both ways, but if a Jew is known to have had a relationship with a non-Jew, and the genders, the sexes of the Jew and non-Jew don't matter here, if they've known to have a relationship beforehand, then after that person converts, they're supposed to not be able to go back and live together. That was the halacha at the time of the Mishnah, time of the Gemara, and that became a very difficult issue in already the 1800s, late 1800s, early 1900s, for sure. We've seen Rav Kook talk about that issue, whether or not we let those people convert, and if they convert, we let them stay together. That's one issue, and so that is an issue that touches on here. So the first question he says is, are we clear that her conversion is invalid? So he goes through a whole discussion where he points out that, and it's the language of the Shulchan Aruch isn't perfectly clear, but it would seem to be that when it comes to the tefillah, the immersion in a mikvah, the necessary requirement of the three is, now there's this word only that people misunderstand all the time, is only lechatchila. So only lechatchila, people take to mean, well, if you have a problem, you can dispense with it. We're going to see some of that here as well, but it doesn't really mean that, right? Lechatchila really means that you have to do it that way. Only if, after the fact, people come to us and say, well, we didn't do it that way, sometimes we say, you don't have to go and do it again, right? And that would be called b'di'evit, you don't have to do it again. So he says, but if you look carefully there, he thinks the language of, we're not going to get to the language and try to have the right inference, but he thinks the language is that it's in terms of, if it's a man converting the circumcision, that's also supposed to be in front of three people, but b'di'evit, if it was only in front of one, that could be good enough, and the tefillah, the immersion in the mikvah. But in terms of Kabbalat HaMitzvot, in terms of the converting person, the new Jew, as we could say, call this person, the person who's converting to Judaism, for the Kabbalat HaMitzvot, for the acceptance of the Torah and the obligation to follow the mitzvot, that he thinks necessarily, even b'diavad, even if they already did it, when they come to us and they say, well, we already did it, that will say, well, you have to do it again. The Rif and the Rambam actually seem to think that other parts of the conversion also have to be done, even b'diavad for three, but we don't have to worry about them if that's not the way we hold. So leaving aside whether we can trust the Rav who wrote that there was a good valid conversion, Zudeh says clearly we can't trust him because he did it the wrong way and he probably wrote them that letter for some other purpose and therefore we can't trust him at all. And then there's a question in the Shulchan Aruch about what Shulchan Aruch actually means. So the Zudeh says it's fairly clear to him that he means that when they come to us, we're supposed to do it. When we are going to tell them about mitzvot, that also should ideally have three. To let them know what the mitzvot are and teach them about the mitzvot in the final stage of the process. Meaning not that the whole training has to be before three, but that there's two stages. We have to, the court is supposed to tell them about all the mitzvot, and then there's somebody who has to witness them accepting the mitzvot, and those are different kinds of things. And it could be that for the telling them about the mitzvot, even one person could qualify even at that late stage. But for the hearing the Kabbalah the mitzvot, for the hearing them announce their readiness to fulfill the mitzvot, that, the Sri Deish says, is understands to be absolutely necessarily in front of three. Along the way, by the way, he says that the Kabbalah the mitzvot is the ikar ha-gerut. The acceptance of the obligation of mitzvot is the essence of gerut, which is something even today I'm not sure that people would necessarily recognize. They might think, no, well, as long as you go to mikvah, you're a ger. But he says, well, the ikar ha-gerut, and that's why it's even b'diavad that you need three, would be the acceptance of mitzvot. That being true, it becomes questionable as to, let's so, now that he's established that he's pretty sure that the first conversion was invalid, at least in terms of Kabbalah the mitzvot, because he didn't have three, are we allowed to now be megayer her, allow her to become a giyoret, because he's living with her, and they're married, they have a civil marriage, and they live as husband and wife, and so he says the gedolim of the previous generation already had this problem, had this concern. Many said that you can't convert her in terms of allowing them to live together as husband and wife, and they had a Rashba and a Nemuka Yosef who helped them in that situation to come to that conclusion. That's the way they felt the halacha was. And then there are others who said that there's ways to be lenient, that if they've already lived together, you can say they meant to, they thought they were doing it the right way. That the Sudeish rejects, but there are others who are making all of this issue as well. So, because if they're already civilly married, they'll say that since she can stop him from marrying anybody else, and people being able to be married, Jews and non-Jews being able to be married, is in fact in halacha. We see Gemaras and Mishnayos that care a great deal about that, feel that it's important for people to be able to be married. So if she can stop him from getting married to anybody else, then you have a situation, and therefore it's like a shat hatchak. And a shat hatchak, a time of pressure, a time when there's no other good solutions. So the issue is that's like a b'diavad. So maybe if it's like a b'diavad, then she's allowed to, we're allowed to be megayer her and let them live together. The Rambam in Pe'er Hador had a tshuva also where he referred to bearing a shifcha. So that was a partially converted slave or something, and he had said, based on another Gemara, on a Gemara that talks about this in other situations, mutav shiyuchlu basar timutot shikutot, that there's times when we say, let's do a smaller thing, and even though it's not great, but it's not, and better do a lesser thing than have all sorts of worse situations going on, such as his living with a non-Jew, and so too, other Chuvot said the same thing, including Achiezer of Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, who was one of the giants of the pre-war generation, and different Chaim. So there are people who are leading on these issues, and that to help this man not do worse Averot, we will do this lesser situation, which is to allow her to be mitgayeret, even though that's not what the original preference in halacha was. As he says, I would just point out that this is an example of where people's actions force, and I put that in quotation marks, but it's a real thing, force halacha to go in directions it doesn't want to go in. In any case, here it's going to be one derabanan, that's going to be a problem one time, as opposed to them living their whole life together in sin, and therefore he thinks there's room to be mekel, to follow that avenue of kula. So that sounds good, except that he then adds, but essentially you have to know that when she's doing this Kabbalah mitzvot, when she's accepting to observe mitzvot, we have to be very sure that she really means it. And then he says, and this is one of the early examples I know of where we start defining orthodoxy in a certain way. He says, it's got to be that she means to observe Tarat Nashim, right, which we call today Tarat HaMishpacha, family purity laws, meaning she'll go to mikvah regularly, Shabbat, and Ma'achalot Asarim, and kosher. So he's saying that for, he's saying here, he doesn't give a reason why he thinks those are the three, but for a minimal Kabbalah mitzvot, it has to be she agrees to go to mikvah regularly, she agrees to keep Shabbat, and she agrees to eat, to only eat kosher and to avoid non-kosher foods. That's an interesting standard for today's Kabbalah mitzvot in terms of there are all sorts of conversion controversies that go on today and what's considered a convert, what's not considered a convert. People sometimes see people convert and they see their actions later and say, oh, that can't be really a convert. Just pointing out the Sri Deish in a non-political context, assumes that's the minimum that we have to have. And then he says that she has to accept it in writing that she's going to observe these things. If she does, and we believe her, then there's room to allow her to convert. There's room for us to oversee her conversion and accept it, and to create a wedding. But he says, if you know she's not going to keep the mitzvot, you're not allowed to convert her in any way. That's a topic come up today as well, that without a meaningful Kabbalah mitzvot, and now we've seen the minimum standard that he holds, without a meaningful acceptance of observance, then there really can't be a conversion, right? One question is, are you allowed to convert because of the way they've lived until now? Now the second question is, okay, but can you convert in terms of what the future is going to look like? And the Sidi Eis is very clear that even according to the lenient opinions, he holds you can't convert somebody if there's not a meaningful acceptance of mitzvot. And then he goes into, you know, if she's pregnant, there are people who are making it in certain ways, but the acceptance of the mitzvot is to him completely a minimum in this way that we said. So you have two tshuvot of the Sidi Eis for the 26th of Tammuz, one about the size of openings and his feeling that if once an opening is larger than a coin, if it's a certain kind of an opening, it already counts in terms of allowing Tumah and Tahara to pass through. And the other one about who we can and cannot convert for the purpose of marriage, even if it's not what we would have preferred, and what the minimum standards for that are. I hope you have a great day, and I hope our time together has been productive for you, and that we meet again for times of Torah and for times of sharing Torah. Have a great day.